From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, 100 years of the FDA. We talk with Philip Hiltz, who covers health and science policy for the New York Times. In his new book, Protecting America's Health, he chronicles the history of the Food and Drug Administration and the struggles and crises that defined what its role would be. Also, the Chicago-based jazz and blues label Delmark is celebrating its 50th anniversary. We meet founder and owner Bob Kester. The label has recorded Junior Wells, Little Walter, Big Joe Williams, Coleman Hawkins, Sun Ra, and many others. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush welcomed today's launch of a so-called roadmap to peace in the Middle East, but cautioned that it must begin with a crackdown on terrorism.
In order for there to be a peace in the Middle East, it is important for all parties to assume the necessary responsibilities to achieve the conditions so that peace can happen. That starts with fighting off terror.
The plan was developed by the U.S., Russia, the United Nations, and the European Union. It lays out a timeline that could lead to the establishment of a Palestinian state by 2005 if the two sides achieve a ceasefire. It would require Israel to withdraw its troops from Palestinian towns and to dismantle some Jewish settlements, while Palestinians would have to crack down on militant groups. The roadmap was delivered less than a day after a suicide bombing at a beachfront cafe in Tel Aviv. Israeli officials said the bomber was a British citizen, as was a second attacker who escaped when his bomb failed to detonate. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
An Israeli police spokesman said the British man who managed to escape after scuffling with bystanders at the pub was named Omar Khan Sharif. Israeli security forces have asked the public's help in locating him. Israeli analysts said it was believed to be one of the only cases of a suicide bomber who was a citizen of a foreign country. Two men and a woman were killed in the explosion and more than 30 injured, including the security guard who stopped the bomber from entering the pub. Two Palestinian organizations, Hamas and the Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigades, said they carried out the bombing jointly as a message to the incoming Palestinian government of Mahmoud Abbas. Abbas has called for an end to terrorism on all sides. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
President Bush signed a law today creating a nationwide Amber Alert system designed to quickly spread word when a child is kidnapped. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president spoke of the need to protect children before an audience that included several well-known survivors of kidnappings, including 15-year-old Elizabeth Smart of Utah, who was joined by her parents in what was her first formal public appearance since she was returned home 7 weeks ago. Also in attendance were relatives of the late Amber Hagerman, whose 1996 murder inspired the law. President Bush said this system will be a major help to police.
No family should ever have to endure the nightmare of losing a child. Our nation grieves with every family that has suffered unbearable loss.
The Amber Alert system is already in place in 41 states. The bill establishes uniform procedures and provides grant money for the expansion of the program nationwide. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 23 points to close at 8,480 in heavy trading. Advances led declines by 5-3. The Nasdaq lost 7 points. This is NPR News. A leading Arabic newspaper has published a letter it said was from former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. The letter urges the Iraqi people to rise up and expel U.S. and British forces. NPR's Kate Seeley reports from Beirut.
The London-based El Quds Al Arabi splashed the letter across its front page. Editor Abdulbari Atwan said the Daily had received the letter by fax on Tuesday. Atwan said it was handwritten, signed by Saddam Hussein and dated April 28, his birthday. El Quds Al Arabi quoted sources close to Saddam confirming that the handwriting and signature were authentic. The letter called upon Iraqis to kick out the infidel occupier, saying Iraq would be victorious. It also urged the Iraqi people not to descend into sectarian strife. On Tuesday, El Quds Al Arabi published a letter from a previously unknown Iraqi resistance group saying Saddam was still alive and would soon deliver a message. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Beirut.
The State Department says there was a sharp decline in international terrorist attacks in 2002. Iraq and six other countries were still listed as supporters of terrorism, but the State Department's counterterrorism chief said steps are being taken to remove Iraq from the list now that Saddam Hussein has been ousted. The other countries on the list are Cuba, Iran, Libya, North Korea, Syria, and Sudan. The report said Iran was the most active supporter of terrorism, giving assistance to Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in the West Bank and Gaza. The State Department said, however, that there were 44% fewer terror attacks in 2002 than there were the year before. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR online shop now features a selection of portable, shortwave, and classic AM/FM radios at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. 100 years ago, it was anyone's guess what the ingredients were for the patent medicines Wheeler's Nerve Vitalizer or Swain's Panacea. And many foods were sold by weight, which encouraged manufacturers to cut them with all sorts of cheap filler. Brown sugar, which had been adulterated with the carcasses of lice, gave rise to an ailment known as grocer's itch. The Food and Drug Administration was created to counter scams like this, and nowadays, thanks to the FDA, we can have more confidence in the safety of most medicines and foods on the market. In the new book, Protecting America's Health, about the history of the FDA, Philip Hiltz writes that it was the first citizen protection agency of the federal government, and it became a model for subsequent regulatory bodies such as the EPA, the FTC, and the SEC. Hiltz is a science and health policy writer for the New York Times. He's also the author of several books, including Smokescreen, The Truth Behind the Tobacco Industry Cover-Up. I asked him to remind us what the food and drug industries were like at the turn of the 20th century.
There were no very good medicines. There were very few things that worked. At the same time, you were just beginning to get the advertising, for the first time, national advertising. So there's this huge voice, this huge mechanism to deliver these messages about all these quack drugs. And the sales started taking off. The advertising in all the newspapers around the country, more than half of it was these quack drugs. So it was this tidal wave of remedies out there. At the same time, you had the food products, which used to be local, used to be within a couple of miles of your house, you got your cabbages and whatnot. But now things were being shipped a long way, so you had to start messing with them, and the chemistry was available to do that, things that would preserve them. So you'd put them on a train car, and then they'd go to the major city, and then you'd produce foods in jars and cans and whatnot. So the whole nature of delivering foods and medicines was changing. And you had a tremendous amount of corruption. For example, if you had opium that you needed, doctors needed to use for pain killing, it turned out that half of the time it was cut very deeply so that it had very little effect, or it was corrupted, or there was flour in it, or all kinds of things. And there was no regulation to deal with this.
The FDA had a slow start. It began just with a $5,000 appropriation from President Roosevelt to a certain Dr. Wiley to conduct experiments called poison squad experiments on food. He experimented on the common preservatives used then. At that time, was there a clear sense of what scientific method was, how to go about testing and data collecting and setting standards of safety for food and drugs?
They didn't know how to test things. They didn't know exactly what the effect of these chemicals being put into food in large numbers would be. There were no rules about it. So Harvey Wiley, who was this Indiana farmer become chemist in Washington, was saying, well, let us start testing these things. So how do you test them? Well, there was no real clinical testing at the time, no testing of drugs, no testing of chemicals in humans. So he kind of had to invent it. What he did simply is he put an ad in the paper saying, I'd like young men to come forward and we'll feed you every day, three meals a day. On the other hand, we're also going to add a little poison to your food. We're going to add these chemicals one after the other and see if it affects you, see if you get sick. And so he got these young men together. They sat at the table every day. Sometimes he made the meals, and very plain food. Meat and potatoes kind of thing. There was nothing on it at first. Then the second week, they'd start adding boric acid or formaldehyde. Each week, they would go along and increase the dose until people started getting sick. and they would record all this. They'd take the urine samples, they'd take the feces samples, and they couldn't eat anything anywhere else. So you had this really peculiar little experiment. And his idea was to see if this was really disastrous on the innards. They had no idea. Nobody had ever tried it before. And it turned out that several of them, they did get sick on those chemicals, especially in the higher doses, quite ill, in fact, laid out some of them flat. But all of this was being covered by the newspapers, and they really loved it, the whole idea of the poison squad, these young men going in to volunteer for mankind to take poisons and see if these things were bad for the human diet.
Who did Dr. Wiley recruit for the poison squad? Was it down-and-out Skid Row types?
He put an ad in the paper, and the people who responded actually were junior clerks in the agriculture department, people who had seen the ad and who were working in the same building with Wiley. Actually, there's quite a few people who signed up, but he took those because they knew something about the subject. They were young, healthy men, and they were ready to go.
How did a food and drug bill ever get passed?
Eventually, the pitch got to the level where there were stories pretty regularly in women's magazines about such things as the soothing syrups that were given to children. Well, what they had in them was opium, and if you give children, very young children, doses of opium, frequently you can kill them, and they did that. There were quite a few deaths from these things. Of course, it was not labeled. It didn't say it was opium. It just said it was a soothing syrup. Same thing with other things that had alcohol in them, 40 proof, 50 proof, 60 proof, and these were being given to children or taken by adults who didn't know that it was alcohol and whatnot. So there were one abuse after another got written about, and the pitch went higher and higher until finally there was this book called The Jungle, Upton Sinclair, in which he went into a slaughterhouse and he was writing about the conditions in a slaughterhouse under which food was made, the meat was made, the sausages were made. He was trying to write about the condition of the workers, but what happened was his descriptions of the grotesqueness of the food was so great that people were picking up his book and vomiting and were getting really outraged about the condition of meat. And that created a crisis for Roosevelt and a crisis in the country about the regulation of food and drugs. And since there had been bills out there, not passed, but they were sitting there ready to go just in case, and this crisis came along, that's when it was passed.
You write that the first real opportunity for change in the regulation of food and pharmaceuticals after the establishment of the FDA didn't come until after the Depression in the 1930s, decades later. Why did food and drug regulation take on an urgency then when there were so many pressing economic and social crises to deal with?
First of all, the whole idea of regulation was revolting to people in the U.S. because it was against ideology at the turn of the century. That was changing, and it changed quite dramatically with the Depression because businesses that had been these great institutions, they were the engines of America at one point, now all of a sudden were the opposite. They were the demons. The whole thing had come apart. The idea of speculation, the idea of businesses dealing for themselves and paying no attention to the people and what the economy and the needs of the nation were, the entire picture changed with the Depression. And so on the list of things to do in the FDR years, they had to reform banking, they had to reform the economy, they had to do something about the stock market and speculation. They did all these things. And then down at the bottom of the list, there was a question about food and drugs because they had the sense that things were going wrong and they needed to be fixed. But it wasn't the top of the list. So what happened was they drafted a bill and they debated it. It was in Congress, but it went nowhere. There were other things were going on until a crisis came along. And this is usually the way this works with FDA. You have to have several things present at the same time. You have to have a physical crisis in which drugs or something is killing people. You have to have a bill already ready. You have to have the debate already well along. And then if those three things come together, then you can get a change. In this case, what happened was a thing called sulfanilamide, elixir of sulfanilamide. It was an antibiotic substance that was given mainly to children, for example, when they had strep throat. It was originally in a powder or in a pill, and it was very bitter and terrible tasting. And so the idea was there was a chemist at a company called Massengill that wanted to put it in a liquid form, easier to swallow, especially for children. So he did that. He took something off the shelf, this Swedish liquid, and he put the powder in, and then he put 240 gallons of it together and sent it out to the pharmacies. No testing, no sense that you had to test. It was not necessary to test at the time. It turned out that what he used to dissolve the powder was diethylene glycol, which is essentially antifreeze, which is highly toxic. And within a few weeks, he killed about 107 children. And the reaction was this terrible fright about the possibility of all these other drugs. And there were many others out there, and cosmetics as well, that were creating troubles, that now it was time to do something about these products, mainly to test them before you put them out. Instead of letting them put them out, watch the damage happen, and then call them back, the idea was, let's not do that anymore. Let's test them before they get out there.
What was the effect of this 1938 drug bill? And you say this is a landmark in civil governance, not only for the U.S., but for democratic governments around the world, that this one bill had that much significance.
This was another principle that was invented with FDA, the principle of regulation, and that is that the businesses are out there, and they're huge factors, these huge corporations. The founding fathers never conceived that these would exist at all. They were brand new on the landscape, and they were very powerful, and there was no countervailing force. So the idea is that the businesses are focused on making a profit. That's okay. They're major engines of democracy, major engines of society. That's fine. But you need some countervailing force for when they get out of hand.
Now, this 1938 law was also key in establishing the idea of prescription medicines, which didn't exist before then. How are they related?
Drugs at that time, of course, people went into the pharmacy and got them themselves. They mostly didn't have to have doctors intervene. It was very rare that they needed that because most of the drugs were ordinary remedies. But they put in a little line saying that with some particularly hazardous drugs, they needed to go to the doctor and get a script from him before they could go to the pharmacy and get it made. They thought that there would be only a few of those kind of drugs. But it turned out that the companies began to see it quite differently, that instead of advertising to the entire population and putting all these labels on, you know, label with all these things about hazards and safety and testing on each drug, they thought, well, maybe we just limit it to the doctors and we make most of the drugs prescription. We make most of them ones where the patient has to go to the doctor, get a script. That way, we can limit our audience. We only have to advertise to doctors. We can control what it is. We don't have to put all those labels out. So it was an idea of industry taking advantage of this little line in the regulation. And so the whole system of prescription drugs was born out of that, essentially looking for a commercial advantage out of that one line.
I'm talking with Philip Hiltz. He writes about science for the New York Times and the Washington Post. His new book is a history of the Food and Drug Administration. It's called Protecting America's Health. Philip, we're going to take a break now, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is science writer Philip Hiltz. His new book is Protecting America's Health, the FDA, Business, and 100 Years of Regulation. Now, the drug that you write caused a turning point for the FDA was thalidomide. Could you first just remind us how the thalidomide disaster unfolded? And thalidomide was a drug developed by the Vicks company, as in Vicks Vapor Rub. It was marketed, among other things, as a treatment for nausea during pregnancy in this country, with tragic results.
Yes, the drug was a sedative. At the time, barbiturates were used to calm people down, but those were quite hazardous, and people even used them for suicide. So it was really a serious issue, and the companies, the drug companies, were looking for a way of calming people without having these very heavy drugs. So they thought, well, this is a pretty good one. It was started in Germany, and in Germany they had done some tests. It looked pretty good in the lab, and they had tried it with some patients. There were no regulations. You didn't have to ask a patient, do you want to take this and all. They just did experiments. They just put them in people, and it looked like it calmed people down and didn't have many side effects. So this company in the U.S. picked it up. Several companies had a chance at it. Other companies looked at it and tried it. It didn't look that good, and it looked like it might be hazardous, so they dropped it. But this other one, Richardson Merrill, which is part of the Vicks company at the time, decided to pick it up and use it, and they were selling it as the tranquilizer, the sedative that has no side effects. This is a miracle drug coming along. We can all be calm now without worrying about barbiturates or poisoning or suicide. But as it turned out, it wasn't quite that way. They didn't do the testing in humans. They did no testing before they delivered it directly to the physicians' offices, and the physicians gave it to their patients, saying, here, try this thing out. This is a sedative. And, of course, in the population of people trying it out were women who were pregnant, and they had not done any of that testing. At the time, they could have. The drug before this that they put out there, they had tested for effects on fetuses. But this one, they were quite anxious to get it out there. So they did this experiment, which at the time was the largest clinical trial experiment ever done in the world. 1,200 doctors and 20,000 patients. They weren't actually taking data. They weren't writing down what happened to the women or to the other people. They just wanted to get it out there and get doctors used to it. So they had done this very large experiment. They wanted to get to the drug to the market quickly because they thought it was going to be a blockbuster.
Now, up until this time, drug companies did not have to get FDA approval to test a drug on the market. Doctors could experiment with these new drugs on their patients with impunity. How did then the thalidomide debacle change that?
What happened was that in other parts of the world where this was already out ahead of the United States, they began to notice two different problems. One is people's nerves went dead in their hands and feet, and this was a direct result of the drug, and they weren't able to reverse it. And so the company outside the United States had to start quietly paying off settlements against themselves because of the problem. And then the other thing they discovered eventually was that because this affects nerves and the growth of nerves, that if a woman was pregnant and just the beginning of her pregnancy and the nerves and the tissues were growing in the fetus, the drug interrupted that. So you had this very strange birth defect called phocomelia, which is seal limbs. And what that is you have hands coming directly out of the shoulder with no limb in between, and the same thing in the legs. You had many other deformities inside the body. Many times the babies didn't make it at all. They died before birth. But the ones that were born were quite deformed. And at the time, the pictures of them were really horrible. So when this happened, the wave of revulsion to the pictures of the birth defects was one that changed what was going into the law. They put into the law for the first time a line saying, if you're going to give experimental drugs to people, you must ask their consent. You must tell them what it's about.
I'm speaking with Philip Hiltz. He writes about science for the New York Times and the Washington Post. He has a new book. It's a history of the Food and Drug Administration. It's called Protecting America's Health. Now, one perception that you address in the book is the image of the FDA as a lethally slow agency. How did it earn that reputation in the first place?
It was a serious problem because when they put the standard in, the companies at the time were not doing serious studies. They were not doing these carefully controlled studies. So the first thing that happens is the FDA says to the company, well, okay, you've got to have a study now. And the company says, well, we've never had to do that before. Well, you have to do it now. So this argument went on and things started slowing down. And so it got to be a terrible fight between the companies and the FDA, which was trying to enforce the law. And then at the same time, the FDA was sitting there. It had very few doctors, so they had to start hiring doctors. They had to start getting scientists in there to look at this evidence. Well, they didn't have the funds for it. Congress was not providing the funds for it. So that even when the evidence did come in, what did you have? You had somebody sitting there. He had four other drugs on the desk. It was going to take him a long time to go through that. So that's how it started out, slow and difficult and fighting and trying to make their way through what the implications of the law were. What were things going to be like in the future when you had to have science actually applied to drugs?
And you argue that this image of the FDA as a bureaucratic and deadly slow and causing a drug lag was solidified by hardline conservatives in the 1980s who deliberately cultivated this image.
of the FDA. How were these attacks, and you label them attacks, orchestrated? Who was the ringleader? What was the venue?
It started out with the slowness of the FDA, and there was actual slowness there. But gradually, of course, the companies and the FDA worked out the problems and got quicker and quicker. But as they were getting faster, say by 1980, 1985, when the pace was picking up and they were learning how to do these things, both the FDA and companies together working it out, there was this injection of conservative feeling into politics in America. There was this rightward turn. And one of the things that came in with the conservatives was this conservative economics. And one of the tenets of conservative economics is that regulation by nature is bad, that you should cut down regulation. Never mind looking at the details, whether this is bad or that is bad. In general, it's bad. And so there was a beginning of a fierce attack from the conservatives, from the conservative economists on the FDA because it was a regulatory agency. And there had been a couple of scientific papers on this issue of whether the FDA was too slow. So they grabbed hold of those and made an issue of it and talked about this is slow. That means that these drugs are not getting to the people. They're causing health damage. The economy is bad for it because the cost of regulation are on the heads of the companies, and then the companies have to pass them along so the drugs are too expensive. And they made this argument against regulation without actually looking into the details of what was going on between the FDA and the companies, the progress that had been made. So it was essentially from ideology that the attack came.
Philip Hilt writes about science and health for the New York Times and the Washington Post. His new book is Protecting America's Health. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Lay That Trumpet in Our Hands, a novel set in 1951 Florida at the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement by Susan Carroll McCarthy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, 50 years of the Delmark Jazz and Blues record label. We talk with founder and owner Bob Kester. We're listening to one of their recordings right now. Also, more of our conversation with Philip Hiltz about the history of the FDA. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's return to our interview with Philip Hiltz. His new book about the history of the FDA is Protecting America's Health. When we left off, we were talking about the deregulatory campaign that the new right waged against the FDA. Now, this was all happening in the 80s, just as the AIDS epidemic was surfacing. And at first, of course, there was no proven drug treatment for AIDS, but there were plenty of supposed or experimental or fraudulent treatments. And the FDA came under repeated attack, not only from the new right, but also from gay activist groups who accused it being a roadblock to potentially effective drugs to treat AIDS. ACT UP singled out the FDA in marches on Washington. So how well-founded were those accusations? Did the FDA deserve the blame for a drug lag, at least in finding good treatments for AIDS?
The difference between the attacks from the right and left were really interesting at the time, because the AIDS groups, and I was covering AIDS at the time and spent a lot of time with them, they wanted the FDA to put out treatments, even untested treatments in the very beginning. They wanted anything they could get, the bathtub treatments, anything they could get. They wanted to relax the rules so you could get other things outside the country, just out of desperation. There was no sense that any of these things might really work or that they could be tested. They just wanted things. And the FDA was a roadblock because they had been testing things, holding things back that were untested. So they negotiated the sides, and the AIDS activists worked with the FDA, and it got to a point where they began to see the rationale for testing the drugs. And as soon as they had something that actually started working, then the thinking began to change, that now you have a drug that actually works with AIDS. Now let's not have all this other junk out there, because that's going to distract people and keep them from getting what they need. And so their thinking, the AIDS activists, evolved with the FDA, and they eventually became quite conservative about it and wanted to be very careful about what was put on the market, and encouraged extra testing, encouraged strict rules, because what they were after was good treatments, well-tested, that actually had an effect on AIDS. On the other hand, the right motivation was not that. The right motivation was business freedom and profits, and so as the FDA evolved and changed its attitude and found good drugs and tried to get them out, the attitude of the right did not change. They did not learn with the FDA how to do these things. They had the position essentially that they wanted to eliminate the function of the FDA, wanted to go directly from business to the public with drugs and let the businesses themselves take care of testing.
I'm thinking that there's been a series of controversies in the past decade over certain pharmaceuticals, obesity drugs, diabetes drug, Rizulin, the flu drug, Relenza, also ephedra, a dietary supplement. And I wonder if there's a chain of effects that came of this deregulation furor in the 80s. In the end, did the FDA, the agency, cave to pressures and rush the drug approval process too much, or seesaw between releasing some drugs with too little testing and some drugs with too much?
Yeah, a number of people have said that. There have been news stories about that, saying that the FDA was conservative at one point, and after being hammered by the right, then they went the other way and put things out too fast. It's pretty hard to tell, because at FDA what's happening is drug by drug things are getting approved. You can certainly say that there was one year, 1997, in which there were drugs put out that had to be pulled back later because of the deaths and injuries they were causing. Seven drugs pulled back out of one year's approval is an enormous number. I mean, for the FDA, that had never happened before. And so there was a sense that things had gotten too lax. It's not clear to me exactly whether that's true or not, but certainly that was the feeling. And so what you have now is, again, that tension, and we have a new commissioner now who is a conservative economist, and the question is he going to push forward and try to get drugs approved much faster, maybe too fast, the way it happened in 1997, or are we at a point where we know now how to regulate drugs at the right speed, not too fast, not too slow?
Philip Hiltz, thanks very much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Philip Hiltz's new book is Protecting America's Health. Coming up, we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Delmark label. This is Fresh Air. Back in 1952, 17-year-old Bob Kester, driven by his passion for jazz and blues and in need of a place to put his collection of 2,000 albums, opened the Jazz Record Mart in St. Louis. A year later, he started his own label, Delmark Records, which is now celebrating its 50th anniversary with the release of a 2-CD set. It includes a previously unreleased track from the first recorded band on the Delmark label, the Windy City Six, playing Royal Garden Blues, which we're listening to now. Kester says the record label is like an overgrown hobby for him. It's the record store, now located in Chicago, that has enabled him to record such blues and jazz artists as Buddy Guy and Junior Wells, Sleepy John Estes, Otis Rush, Sun Ra, and Archie Shepp. Over the years, Kester has been a mentor and father figure for many Chicago musicians. He's considered one of the major forces behind the blues revival in the mid-60s. This year, the Chicago Blues Festival and the Chicago Jazz Festival are both planning special lineups to celebrate Delmark Records. Terry spoke with Bob Kester earlier this month.
Bob Kester, welcome to Fresh Air and happy anniversary.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
I thought we could start by playing what I believe is a track from your first blues LP, featuring the singer and pianist Speckled Red. Was this, in fact, your first?
Yes, the first blues artist I recorded back in, I think, 55.
Well, tell us who he is and how you ended up recording him.
Well, Speckled Red was one of the pioneers of boogie-woogie piano, pre-Pete Johnson, Albert Ammons, born in the late 1890s. We had no idea. I was living in St. Louis at the time, just beginning to get started in the business, and had no idea he was in the city, in St. Louis. And he was discovered by a guy named Charlie O'Brien, a policeman, whom I met at the St. Louis Jazz Club, who wanted to look up some old people. He had this veneration for old people because his parents had been killed in robberies. And we gave him a list of blues artists who were around St. Louis, and he found all of them, and one of them, Mary Johnson, Lonnie Johnson's ex, happened to mention, oh, I saw Speckled Red the other day. So, and when you hear the record, I think people understand if their concept of boogie-woogie is Otis Spann or Roosevelt Sykes or Albert Ammons, they can see how different this is. This is regional boogie-woogie from Georgia.
Well, let's hear Speckled Red's version of Cow Cow Blues as recorded by you in 1956. Speckled Red, recorded in 1956 on the Delmark label, and my guest Bob Kester is the founder of the label, and Delmark is celebrating its 50th anniversary. Well, let's hear another recording that you've made that's on your new 50th anniversary anthology. Now, why was Big Joe Williams willing to record for you, Bob Kester, who at the time was a very young, inexperienced producer with very little track record?
Well, whether he was on Delmark or BJ or Trumpet, he was getting union scale, and the sad fact was his records weren't selling very well. I think he was intrigued with the idea of being on an LP.
Was this his first LP?
Oh, yeah.
He'd made 78s and 45s before that?
It came close to being the first LP of Mississippi Country Blues.
This is a great track. Why don't we hear this 1958 recording featuring Big Joe Williams doing Midnight Creep. Now, this is actually previously unreleased. I think it was recorded for that first LP that you were referring to, but it wasn't released as part of it. Why not?
We just never had the money. Joe is just a fountain. It's just like turning on a water tap. The music would come pouring out, and he would record an enormous amount of material at every session, and you just had to go through and pull out what you felt worked together as an album. You try to program an album, and I was trying to program an album toward ears that weren't yet geared to blues. You never needed second takes with Big Joe Williams.
Okay, well, here it is from 1958, Big Joe Williams, Midnight Creep.
Lord, I wonder where baby gone is. Well, I wonder where my baby gone is. Says she left this morning, I haven't did nothing wrong. Well, I feel like walking, baby, talking all night. Well, I feel like walking, baby, talking all night. Well, the woman I'm loving, she sure don't treat me right. Well, I wonder why my baby done is home. Well, I wonder why my baby done is home. She been gone, left me, and I sure don't feel wrong. I got 19 women, Lord, I want one more.
That's Big Joe Williams, recorded in 1958. That track is featured on the new Delmark Records 50th Anniversary Anthology of Jazz and Blues. My guest, Bob Kester, is the founder of Delmark Records, and he also runs he owns the Jazz Record Mart in Chicago. You know, if the guitar playing sounded a little unusual on that, it's because one reason is because Big Joe Williams played a 9-string guitar. Tell us a little bit about that guitar.
Well, Joe got tired of people borrowing his guitar or just picking it up between sets and playing it, so he rigged up the 9-string. It was, I think, to some extent a gimmick, and he apparently had some kind of strange tuning that other people couldn't cope with. And that had a lot to do. That's what he says was the reason. But, of course, he developed a rather unique sound eventually.
It sounds like a pretty weird reason to start playing a 9-string guitar.
Well, those guitars were usually his most valuable possession, and right. He didn't want people messing with it.
Some of the people who've worked in your record store have gone on to be, you know, record producers or recording artists. One of the people who worked in your record store, Bruce Iglauer, founded Alligator Records, which is a blues label in Chicago. And in an article about you, he was quoted as saying about you, he's terribly argumentative. He hardly says anything nice about anybody, but he's just as generous as hell. He almost fired me a couple of times, mostly for good reasons. And at the same time, he was extraordinarily nice to me. It's hard to explain. Bob will snarl at people. He used to break 78s over his employees' heads. So I want to hear about you breaking 78s over your employees' heads.
Oh, well, we always have 78s that are worthless. And 78s break pretty good, pretty well. I always made sure they weren't Columbias, because Columbias had paper lamination in them. They made them a deadly weapon. Or Edison's, which are terrible. Well, Edison's are too valuable. I don't think I did that very often, and it was pretty much a jovial thing. And there were probably records that were cracked anyway. Happily, nobody got hurt. I've been called a curmudgeon. And when I got married back in 67, people would approach me and say, hey, you know, you're mellowing out. What's happened? Well, at least one of life's problems has been solved. As the money got better, I probably got a little easier to get along with. We still have our arguments, though. I doubt the two of us would ever agree on a mix. You know.
Did you ever break a 78 over somebody's head and realize years later that it was actually a decent 78 and was worth a lot of money?
No, I always make sure it was something by Perry Como. Perry Como was on Victor. They're the most brittle, breakable records ever made in that period.
Now, I believe that the best-selling record in the Del Mar catalog is an album that you recorded in 1965 with guitarist Buddy Guy and harmonica player Junior Wells.
Yes, Hoodoo Man Blues. It's our, I guess, our hit, closest thing to a hit.
How many copies does that mean?
About 250,000 mm-hmm. that I know of. There were licenses made to unethical foreign labels who pressed records and shipped them over here in boatloads that might have upped that somewhat.
This album with Junior Wells and Buddy Guy sold better than anything else in the Del Mar catalog. What do you think it was about the music and the time and place that made it do so comparatively well?
Well, I think to some extent we got in on the ground floor. It was the first time a working Chicago blues band went into a studio to make an album rather than a single. And, well, Junior Wells is a heck of a band leader and organizer. It's an aspect of his talent very few people have ever paid tribute to. And we just sort of, I think people maybe were looking for something in Chicago blues beyond the reissues of the Chess, Muddy Waters, Howling Wolf, etc. And there was a certain freedom of time. There was no 2.5-3 minute limitation. Oddly enough, it got a 2-star review in Downbeat, but it did pretty well in the folk press.
Well, you know, on the new Del Mar Records 50th anniversary collection, you include a 1953 Junior Wells recording. That's a session that you actually leased from another record company. So I thought we could play that 1953 session, which is Junior Wells' first recording session, back-to-back with mm-hmm. something from Hoodoo Man Blues, the record that we've been talking about that you released in 1965.
You can hear Junior's voice grow up between the two dates.
So here it is.
That's two recordings by Junior Wells, the first from 1953, the second with guitarist Buddy Guy, recorded in 1965. Terry's guest is Bob Kester, the founder of Del Mar Records, which celebrates its 50th anniversary this year with a new 2-CD set. We'll hear more of their conversation after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Back now to Terry's interview with Bob Kester, founder of the Delmark record label.
What did you grow up listening to, and how were you exposed to it?
Well, my grandfather had a collection of classical 78s. He died when I was very young, but when we moved into his house, the records were still there, and there was one by the original Dixieland Jazz Band, and one by another group, the California Ramblers or something. That was probably the first jazz records I played, but I had polio in sixth grade, and I heard the Eddie Condon show, the Saturday afternoon jam session, and that had a lot to do with it. But that was, when I was growing up, it was the tail end of this big band swing era. That's the only time when jazz was the popular music in this country, roughly 1935 to the middle 40s. So I got to hear a lot of Basie, and not a lot of Basie and Ellington. They didn't get that much airplay in those Jim Crow days. But I got to hear a lot of Woody Herman and Charlie Barnett and some of Basie. I was able to go see Basie at the Miller Theater. I guess that's the first live jazz I ever heard. And Jimmy Rushing still singing with him. That must have been 47 or 48, something like that.
Did music keep you company when you were stuck at home with polio?
Well, I wasn't. By the time I got out, I kept looking for good jazz when I was in the hospital. When I got home, I didn't want to be around the house. I wanted to get the heck out and around. And I was encouraged to ride bicycles and, you know, to put my legs back into shape.
What's the blues and jazz scene in Chicago like now? And do you feel like you're keeping up with the musicians who are playing today?
Well, I've done quite a few 50th anniversary interviews, and I do get a little frustrated that I'm glad you mentioned that, because we are still recording. We're not just living on records we made in the 60s. There's a lot of good blues in Chicago. There's a lot of clubs, and there are still, and seem to be growing, ghetto blues bars that almost disappeared with the crack epidemic and with the exodus of the musicians to the north side, where of course the money was a lot better. It's still a scene, and it's still part of the part of the folkiness of blues is still there. There's still the connection with the south, the old south. The jazz scene, a lot of the AACM people have left, but we've still got Fred Anderson in the straight ahead field. We've still got Von Freeman. You don't need too many. And visiting New York musicians are sometimes a little bit astounded at what a high percentage of the Chicago jazz men are working regularly, whereas in New York they're sitting around waiting for a gig on the road or something.
Well, we should end with a jazz recording. I should ask you if you have a favorite from the 50th anniversary collection that you'd like to play.
The stuff I'm most proud of is the Roscoe Mitchell and the other AACM records. A part of the catalog that I think is our most important contribution to jazz. We did the first AACM record, the first Roscoe, the first Braxton, the first Mewall.
And AACM, I mean, is the, what's the acronym?
The Association for Advancement of Creative Musicians. This was a group of self-determinist avant-garde musicians in Chicago, and started in the early 60s. And gave birth to all these guys that I've mentioned and many, many more.
And it was the genesis of the Art Ensemble of Chicago.
Right, yeah. I think that was the most important music happening anywhere in the world at that time. I mean, it had its counterparts in Kansas City, St. Louis, and New York, Boston, Philly, and so forth, and it later in Europe. But I think it's our most important contribution. But I have to say, I really enjoy the older stuff more.
So you
I'm
think...
very, very proud of our six sessions with six albums with Art Hodes. He's the only really great musician from the 20s that we took in the studio, although we got a lot of good Earl Hines stuff, too.
So you're proudest of giving some of the Chicago avant-garde their start, but your heart is really with Art Hodes, the stride piano player.
Well, when I go to an avant-garde concert now, I can get into the music a lot better. But I like a drink now and then when I'm listening to music, and it's not really drinking man's music. It's thinking man's music.
Bob Kester, founder of Delmark Records, which celebrates its 50th anniversary this year. Here's a 1976 recording of Art Hodes playing Cakewalkin' Babies from Home. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing, Ian Chillag, and Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, caring for the sick and wounded in a Baghdad hospital, we talk with Dr. Morten Rustrup of Doctors Without Borders. He just returned from 5 weeks in Iraq. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.